So what can we expect in Montreal?
We can expect the same sort of commitment and heart and soul to making it the greatest games, just like Sydney did.
What's, I think, even more touching about that performance and that character is that he's struggling like hell. And there's no example in this world that he lives in of how to realize this other kind of life.
The theme of this movie is it's about living an authentic life. And if you're not living an authentic life, then you're sort of living a life with a secret.
I do think I made him kiss a man for the first time in his life.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Britain plans to axe its grossly indecent laws, Sydney passes the gay games torch to Montreal, and a gay director guides his hetero star far from heaven. All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Dean Elzinga.
And I'm Cindy Friedman.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending November 16th, 2002. Britain's government is moving to repeal three anti-gay criminal laws as part of a sweeping update of sexual offences announced this week in the Queen's Speech, the annual ceremonial outlining of the agenda for the new legislative session. The gross indecency law that convicted author Oscar Wilde in the 19th century has continued to be enforced against gay men into the present, along with laws against buggery and solicitation by men. Home Secretary David Blunkett will publish details in the coming week, but the law reform has been in development for some time, and his office confirms it will eliminate discrimination based on gender and sexual orientation from Britain's criminal code. Sex acts in public places, including public toilets, will remain offenses.
Major reform of the Local Government Act was also in the Queen's speech. Although the Blair government is not expected to seek repeal of the Act's notorious Section 28, which prohibits local governments from devoting resources to the promotion of homosexuality, an amendment to that effect is sure to come from the ruling Labour Party's backbench.
An earlier attempt to repeal Section 28 was quashed by Conservative Party opposition in the House of Lords, but the Tories are still reeling from their division over last week's approval of opening adoptions to unmarried couples, including gay and lesbian couples. This week, Member of Parliament from Blackpool North, Harold Ellison, quit the Conservative Party to join the left-wing third-party Liberal Democrats, saying Tory parliamentary leader Ian Duncan-Smith's hard line against same-gender couples adopting had been the last straw. He called the Conservatives a form of alternative comedy rather than an alternative government.
South Australia's Attorney General Michael Atkinson this week announced his government's plans to review the state's civil rights and anti-vilification laws, including identifying laws that discriminate against same-gender couples. The review committee is expected to report its recommendations by mid-2003. But resistance is growing to some aspects of proposed civil rights expansions in the Australian states of Queensland and Tasmania, particularly from Christian activists.
In Queensland, the target is employment protections for gays and lesbians who work in non-religious roles for churches, including teachers in religious schools. Queensland's opposition National Party has now vowed to campaign against the Labour government's omnibus reforms unless the religious groups are exempted, although the Queensland Nationals lack the numbers to block it. Openly gay federal senator from West Australia, Brian Gregg of the Australian Democratic Party, declared that national civil rights laws already protect gay and lesbian teachers, even in church schools, and called the Queensland protest nonsense.
Tasmania's Catholic and Anglican leaders, Archbishop Adrian Doyle and Bishop John Harrower, this week spoke out against that state's Labour government's plan to open adoptions to same-gender couples who contract what would be Australia's first official registered partnerships for gays and lesbians. Attorney General Judy Jackson responded that the issue was human rights, not morality.
Adoption rights are also generating opposition in Belgium. Justice Minister Mark Verwilgen announced this week that the government is ready to introduce in the Senate a bill to open adoptions to same-gender couples. A Senate committee last month approved a bill to create registered partnerships that does not include adoption rights. But this week's announcement led the CD&V party to declare it will now oppose the partnership measure in the House of Representatives if the government proceeds with the adoptions bill.
In a potential parenting advance for lesbians, Jilin has become China's first province to open access to artificial insemination to unmarried women, as a new state family planning law came into effect last week. That's despite their still being prohibited by law from bearing a child conceived through intercourse. A spokesperson for Jilin's Family Planning Bureau told the South China Morning Post that China's national law prohibiting birth outside marriage is intended to protect China's strong sense of ethics and morality. But what we're trying to do with this legislation is protect the childbearing rights of women who never intend to marry by giving them scientific means. Jilin's law allows artificial insemination to never-married and divorced women at least 20 years old who reside in the province, and while it does not prohibit them from marrying after bearing a child by AI, it does bar them from having another child with that husband. Jilin has one of China's lowest provincial birth rates. During the year-plus Jilin officials spent crafting the new law, they also discussed the parental rights of unmarried men, but that proved so complex that they tabled it for future consideration.
Thai Senator Wallop Tankananurak this week publicly tested the waters for the rights of transsexuals, with a call for them to be legally recognized in their post-surgical gender. The senator expressed confidence that the idea would find support in Thailand's upper house, even though actual legislative change would have to originate in the House of Representatives. He expressed concern to protect male-to-female transsexuals not only from discrimination but from sexual assaults, since under current law, their male attackers would be charged with molestation rather than rape. He also said that they should be allowed to use the titles Miss or Mrs.
Language is also being cleaned up in South Korea as the National Human Rights Commission has settled a petition by the Lesbian and Gay Human Rights Federation and others against respondents including the National Academy of the Korean Language, which publishes the Standard Korean Dictionary. The commission's own investigation confirmed the activists' claim that most Korean and Korean English dictionaries published in Korea use disparaging terms such as sexual perversion in defining homosexuality. The commission announced this week that both sides were satisfied with an agreement by the Academy and nine other publishers to correct discriminatory and disparaging language.
A Korean gay man is believed to be the first to win U.S. asylum from anti-gay persecution in his homeland. The Lesbian and Gay Immigration Rights Task Force, which represented him pro bono, said its documentation shows that Korea continues to be one of Asia's most homophobic nations.
Also in the U.S. this week, Honolulu's Kalaheo High School has become the first in Hawaii to win official charter for a student gay-straight alliance club. It took students more than a year and several attempts to create a set of guidelines that pass muster with school officials. Its goal, like that of thousands of similar groups in 46 other states, is to provide a safe environment by combating homophobia, and its first project is development of a brochure on derogatory language.
The Eugene, Oregon City Council unanimously approved creation of a partnership registry for same-gender couples and prohibited discrimination based on domestic partner status. The registry would be Oregon's third, following Portland and Ashland, but Eugene Mayor Jim Tory may veto it. His opposition to a package of human rights amendments that included the registry was spurred largely by a proposal to make gender identity a category protected from discrimination, and more specifically by the prospect of allowing transgenders to use the bathroom of their choice. In face of his veto threat to the whole package, the council voted 6-2 this week to drop the transgender civil rights amendment.
By contrast, Chicago, Illinois Mayor Richard Daley this week signed into law protections from discrimination based on gender identity under that city's human rights ordinances. Daley may also soon be appointing Chicago's first openly gay city councilor to replace an alderman who's resigning before February's city elections.
But the appointment of Jerusalem's first openly gay city council member has hit a serious snag. The city's Jerusalem Now faction, historically affiliated with the National Meretz Party, which just appointed the first open gay to the national parliament, had chosen gay activist Jerry Levinson to replace one of its resigning members on the council. But Israel's Minister of the Interior, Eli Yishai, of the ultra-Orthodox Shas Party, is stalling on his legal responsibility to formalize the appointments as quickly as possible. Jerusalem Now this week submitted an urgent petition to the High Court of Justice to force Yishai to act immediately. The faction's attorney told the Haaretz newspaper that the minister's role is limited by the law. He has no discretion. He cannot disqualify them if they are not to his liking.
Openly gay Paris Mayor Bertrand Delanoy this week made his first public appearance since narrowly surviving an October assassination attempt by a vocal homophobe. The occasion was observances of Armistice Day, the anniversary of the end of World War I. Delanoy was described as moving stiffly but looking well-rested and said he's feeling much better.
And finally, it's not news that 2nd-century Roman Emperor Hadrian had a love affair with a beautiful young Greek named Antinous. But it's only now been discovered that Hadrian built a temple in his memory. Antinous drowned in the Nile in the year 130, and the grief-stricken Hadrian immediately declared him a god and founded the Egyptian city of Antonopolis on the spot. Statues memorialized Hadrian's lost love throughout the Roman Empire, but no temple was known to exist. Excavations have now found one near the site of Hadrian's headquarters west of Rome, a large semicircular structure with fountains, planters, and niches for statues that's being called the region's most important recent archaeological discovery.
That's News Wrap for the week ending November 16th, 2002. Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm Dean Elzinga.
And I'm Cindy Friedman.
The style comes out of classic movie melodrama, while the story comes out of the closet for a gay director's new movie with a high-powered star. Stay tuned for a heavenly preview later in the program. The 2002 Sydney Gay Games were just drawing to a close, but it wasn't too soon for Canadian Olympic swimming champ Mark Tewksbury to be excited about the next Gay Games. Tewksbury joined fellow organizer Jean-Francois Perrier to talk about the 2006 Gay Games in Montreal with This Way Out correspondent Greg Redding.
We're here with Mark Tewksbury, Olympian, backstroke person, and on the board.
Of Montreal 2006. Very excited about hosting the next Gay Games in 2006.
And also with Jean-Francois Perrier, who's the media person for that committee.
Exactly, till 2006. Why not, huh?
Well, if we hope you last that long. If it's like Sydney, there'll be a big turnover of staff over the few coming years. But tell us about how the Sydney Gay Games were for you, Mark.
Well, I think if I'll speak on behalf of the organization, we just were really impressed. It's been a spectacular week. I think it has to be seen to be believed. There's sort of a magic and a spirit that takes over a city. I think the Gay Games transform Sydney, and I think a little bit Sydney helped transform the Games as well. I think it works both ways, and that's when the magic is created. But it was from the opening ceremony when I think even the most cynic person in the stadium had to sit up and go, wow. We're here, we're thousands and thousands of gay and lesbian and friends on the field participating in sport, and we just kind of took over the city, and it was a great week. The sporting competition was, on one end, really competitive and impressive. To me, as an Olympian, I didn't know what to expect, but genuinely, I was really, really impressed. And on the other hand, there's room for all. You know, it's not just a everybody has to win kind of spirit. There's as much cheering for the 55-year-old gentleman who's last on the track in the 200-meter than the first guy that blew us all away because he still looks like he's 20 years old. So it was a really magical experience and lots to learn. But I think that we realize the Gay Games movement keeps growing and it keeps getting stronger. And I think the spirit of Sydney 2002 and the organizing committee, including the co-presidents Peter and Bev and the CEO Judith, there's a real spirit of collaboration. And so we're not starting from zero. We're really building on what happened here in Sydney.
Did you swim this year, Mark?
I didn't swim. No, I chose in true spirit of the Gay Games values to do something that I would just participate in. So I wasn't kind of caught up in going back to there's a little Olympian still inside and I wasn't quite ready to let that out. I hope to run the 10K road race. I sprained my ankle, as fate have it. I didn't swim. But I did, fortunately, one of my roles was to really travel to a lot of the venues and see a lot of the sports. So I still feel like I participated very much.
Jean-Francois, how did you get involved with the Gay Games?
Well, I work also at Tourism Montreal, and I'm in charge of media relations there and also the development of the gay market to make sure everybody knows that Montreal is a great destination for the gay and lesbian travelers. And then a team was formed to bid for the Montreal for the Gay Games in 2006, and I was asked to join the team. And since then, we've been working very hard into making this happen, the bid, it did, and now we're working even harder to now organize the Gay Games.
Were you taking part in the sport, this Games?
I was supposed to, and it so happened that I was not able to do my cycling, but I wanted to have... I tried to get an idea of what the participants could feel, but I didn't go as far as doing it the day I was supposed to. Something happened.
Oh dear, these things happen that day all the time. So what can we expect in Montreal, Mark?
We can expect the same sort of commitment and heart and soul to making it the greatest games, just like Sydney did. You know, it's a funny thing because the Gay and Gay Games... There's many dimensions to it. It's not just a one-dimensional event. There's culture, there's, you know, sort of a social, political aspect of where we are in the world as gay and lesbian people. And I think all that considered, there's also a commercial marketplace and where gay and lesbians fit within that. And all of those things have an impact on what kind of games we're going to have. But I can't help but think the world we're living in 4 more years, I think right now there's an exponentiation of our outcomes and sort of where we're going as a culture. And I think that Montreal 2006 will just be a great... The title's Rendezvous 2006. It means meeting, coming together and meeting. And I think it's exactly right. It's going to be a meeting of many things. The one special thing about Montreal, I'm not actually from there. I just moved in February. And it's my first summer that I've lived there. And people in Montreal don't travel during the summer. They stay home in general and participate in the numerous festivals that the city has to offer. They just love it. And so we're going to bring them another festival, a sport and cultural festival, and I just think they're going to go crazy for it. I think it's going to be a really great meeting of two, a city and an event.
Because I guess it's very cold there in winter, isn't it, with snow and all that, and then you have a contrast of seasons. The games will be in summer?
Games will be in summer, and that's why Montrealers really don't waste their summers. They're like, you know, it's warm for a couple months a year, we're going to maximize them, and they really do. So it's going to be magic.
Yeah, exactly. The games will be from July 29th to August 5th, which is probably the nicest season or time of the year in Montreal. And of course, at the moment, at home, it's getting a little cooler, and very soon we'll see the snow. But like Mark explained, we really appreciate each of the seasons, and we take advantage of all of them. And summer, Montrealers go crazy in the city. We'll really be upside down for the Gay Games. I'm very sure of that. And not only the gay and lesbian community, but all Montrealers should be behind this beautiful project.
You've been listening to organizers Jean-François Perrier and Mark Tewksbury chatting up the 2006 Gay Games in Montreal with This Way Out correspondent Greg Redding at the close of the 2002 Games in Sydney, Australia.
If you're looking for a codependent lesbian relationship with a needy woman, call me. I'm waiting. I'll move in with you. I'll become allergic to your cats, and when you give them away, I'll break up with you. Is that how you like it? Oh, call me. I'll wear your clothes. We'll go get counseling together and adopt a Nicaraguan crack baby, and then I'll sleep with all your friends. Is that how you like it? Oh, call me. Oh, Mama, you're so good to me. I'll stalk you till you take out a restraining order on me. Is that how you like it? Oh, call me. I've got some hot, steamy issues for you. We'll process everything. I'll make your life hell. Call me. Oh, yeah.
Hi, we're the Nellie Olsons. I'm Nora Burns.
I'm Terrence Michael.
I'm John Cantwell.
And I'm Marissa Copeland.
This is Dorothy Allison, author of Bastard Out of Carolina and numerous trashy pieces. You're listening to This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine.
The critics are applauding Far From Heaven, a new feature film from openly gay director Todd Haynes that explores issues of race, sexuality, and the hunger for acceptance in a stylishly unique way. Haynes and his leading man Dennis Quaid joined This Way Out's Steve Pride for a preview of the movie that proves that everything old really is new again.
In the 1990s, openly gay writer-director Todd Haynes gave us Poison, Safe, and Velvet Goldmine. In his new film, Far From Heaven, he pays an homage to the Douglas Sirk domestic melodramas of the 1950s. And the spectacular result is both one of the best movies of 2002 and one of the bravest of 1957.
Hello, this is Todd Haynes, the writer-director of Far From Heaven. The film's set in Hartford, Connecticut, 1957, and sort of introduces this very idyllic, comfortable American family. Julianne Moore plays Kathy Whittaker, a homemaker with two children, and Dennis Quaid plays her husband, who's the head of a TV sales company in Hartford. And what you begin to realize is that there's a lot going on beneath the surface of this happy life. Frank, the husband, is struggling with questions about his sexuality that are very hard to admit to or even put words to. But ultimately, they take over as the primary crisis between Kathy and Frank, which pulls her away from her social circle in a way that makes her open to a friendship with her very charming and intelligent gardener, a black man named Raymond Deegan, played by Dennis Haysbert. And then that relationship, which is sort of misinterpreted in society, creates a whole other set of crises that teaches this woman a great deal about her world that she didn't really expect to see.
Although the movie is about a marriage in freefall, Frank Whittaker, as played by Dennis Quaid, is presented as neither hero or villain.
That was important to me without playing him for obvious sympathies or a kind of obvious sort of politically correct reading of a gay quest that would necessarily end with a kind of liberationist flag or something, you know, as I think films today feel obliged to provide. So what's, I think, even more touching about that performance and that character is that he's struggling like hell, and there's no example in this world that he lives in of how to realize this other kind of life. How do you dress? How do you walk? How do you move? Where do you live? There's just no examples. There's barely even a language to put it into words, as I said before. So he can be very irritable around her when she's trying so hard to keep it all together and be so nice and be so attentive and so encouraging to his therapy that he begins and all of that. And he's not the nicest guy to be around, but I think that's more honest, you know, and more real than showing him as this sort of idyllic character.
While the film matches the look and tone of classic weepers like All That Heaven Allows and Imitation of Life, according to Todd Haynes, Far From Heaven is a little bolder than was possible in the 1950s.
Themes of homosexuality were not being expressed overtly until the 60s, really, in American film. But it's amazing to see how much it was pervading popular films in the 50s from all of the Tennessee Williams adaptations that were coming out at that time, where homosexuality was often the underlying theme behind crises in relationships, like, you know, why Paul Newman doesn't want to have sex with Elizabeth Taylor in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, or why Blanche DuBois' first love killed himself. These are suggested in these films. Let alone the sort of new kind of masculinity being depicted vis-a-vis Marlon Brando and James Dean and Montgomery Clift, that was this more vulnerable, more sort of subjective, multi-layered depictions of men on screen that came with other thematic eccentricities. The relationship between Sal Mineo and James Dean in Rebel Without a Cause is obviously an infatuation between these two men. And then the Sirk films were sort of surrounded by homosexuality in the producer Ross Hunter, and obviously in Rock Hudson. There were probably ways people could argue that those themes were infusing these films stylistically, visually, in all kinds of ways that weren't necessarily overt, but it was just sort of steaming around the periphery of these films. It's hard for me to talk about the idea of a gay sensibility, a sort of stylistic sensibility, outside of a historical context of what that meant, pre-Stonewall, where the only way some gay artists or artisans in filmmaking could express themselves was circuitously and in all of these various subliminal or formal or stylistic ways. I don't know if that's necessarily true today. It's hard for me to say. It's hard to know where the subversive aspects of gay sensibility have gone, but there was an amazing period pre-Stonewall where all kinds of gay perspectives were infusing dominant culture and providing all kinds of ways of reading dominant heterosexual society that provided a very rich, complex language. It's sad sometimes. I feel like we've lost that because we've come above ground, you know, and a lot of the sort of sense of resistance that was built into that is gone.
Dennis Quaid has been acting for 27 years and has appeared in over 55 films, but this is his very first gay role.
He had no problem or difficulty with what the role entailed. He's a very secure guy. But I do think I made him kiss a man for the first time in his life, or so he said. It took a few takes because he started out with the other actor in a kind of muscular, you know, much more kind of wrestly kind of embrace and kiss. And I kept quieting it down, you know, and refining it. So it was simpler and more like a Hollywood screen kiss from the 50s.
And all those will be on the DVD?
Your own copy only. I can't really make that available.
And what did Dennis Quaid have to say about his first Hollywood screen kiss with another guy?
Well, I didn't get a Woody on it. You know, what the hell? You know, I'm comfortable with my own sexuality to begin with. So it was, why not? So we wound up doing it like about 8 times, something like that. And it was a part of the film. And it was, you know, told within the context of the story. My research was really like my own life and the people that I've known who are gay in my life, you know, like in starting from in high school when some of my friends were first coming out of the closet back then, you know, and how difficult it was for them. And I also have known a few of my friends who have gone through marriage and tried to deny their sexuality, and finally it was too much for them. And you know, what I found is that it's the whole thing, which I think is very much a part of the theme of this movie, is it's about living an authentic life. And if you're not living an authentic life, then you're sort of living a life with a secret, which is what my character was doing. And, you know, he's sort of filled with shame about himself until he really finally admits who he is.
I asked Todd Haynes what he wanted the audience to take away from his film.
I guess the things I hope people take from it is, you know, again, making you really question how much we really have progressed from this time. These themes, which seem rigid and constrained and full of fear in this film, unfortunately, are not themes that we've resolved. And it's alarming to hear how often people tell me, oh yeah, I know people in marriages like this today, when all of a sudden we have all these visible options on television and imaginable alternative lifestyles that they didn't have in the 50s. And yet, there's still such intense fear around taking those risks and changing your life and following your heart.
This has been a conversation with Todd Haynes and Dennis Quaid. Far From Heaven is a Focus Features release. For more information, point your internet browser to www.farfromheavenmovie.com. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. This week, Cindy Friedman, Dean Elzinga, Graham Underhill, Jason Lynn, Chris Ambidge, Rex Walkner, Greg Redding, and Steve Pride contributed program material. Thanks also to Michael Schembri. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can listen to This Way Out anytime online, exclusively on Planet Out. There's a link at our website, thiswayout.org. Some This Way Out operating expenses are funded by a grant from the Arcus Foundation and through direct charitable donations from our listeners. This Way Out is in serious trouble. To find out how you can help keep this program on the air, please visit our website at thiswayout.org, email us at tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks very much for listening on KMUD Garberville, California, WFCS New Britain, Connecticut, 5RRR Woomera, South Australia, and more than 125 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Everybody's going to stay tuned.